This is an interview with U.S. Circuit Court Judge Alfred T. Goodwin, May 5th, 1986, Tape 14, Side 1.
But I remember my children were, during the 60s, were too young. They really didn't become part of the young left until in the 70s. But the children who were getting in trouble with the law frequently were, I mean, and particularly in the marijuana and related juvenile offense area, They weren't seen, at least, as political activists. They were just kids that wanted to experiment with drugs. Later on, when the Vietnam War became much more of a heated national debate, then you could really see the leftward move of the young as they were protesting the war. And you saw that. The Kent State affair and similar affairs locally. I mean, people were protesting the war right down here in front of this courthouse in the early 70s. And that was, some of it was probably a politically left orientation, and some of it was just anti-war. And it's hard to tell who was using whom. I mean, I think there are people in the leadership of these left-wing organizations who are perfectly happy to exploit any kind of unrest anywhere they can find it, mm-hmm. and co-opt the young protesters. On the other hand, some of that protest is probably not partisan. Political protest at all. It's a single issue protest. I mean, you have the abortion, the right to life versus freedom or the choice people. You can sort of identify vague coalitions of political right and left in those groupings, but once that particular issue is resolved, that coalition dissolves too. I mean, the people might not necessarily remain where they are politically after that issue is solved. So there's lots of single issue politics floating around, sort of like pollen for hay fever sufferers. It's there. All those single issues are out there, and if one of them makes you sneeze, why, it's going to make you sneeze, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat.
Mm-hmm. Well, you suggested a couple of minutes ago that your ideas about the war probably shifted as the 60s progressed.
As the war into the 70s.
One into the other. Yeah. I wonder if we could maybe talk a little more specifically about your own political choices in elections during that decade. In 1960, John Kennedy faced Richard Nixon, and you were a nominal Republican, but I think reflecting Oregon's peculiar history of progressive Republicanism. How did you come down in that election? What were some of the
problems? I think I voted for Mark Hatfield, and I didn't like either one of the candidates, the uh-huh. major party candidates, in that election. I think I just wrote in Mark Hatfield as a protest in 1960. I didn't like Kennedy, not because he was a Catholic, which was why my father didn't like him, but I didn't like him because I thought he was too glib, and I didn't like Nixon because he just didn't, I hadn't liked him as a senator.
Yeah.
And I didn't much want to vote for either one of them. In 64, I really felt like it was a Hobson's choice. I didn't trust Johnson at all. And the more I learned about Johnson, the more reason I have to believe my initial instinct was right. And I didn't, I thought Goldwater was too extreme as a almost a caricature of a conservative.
Yeah.
And so I wrote in Hatfield again. in 68, I did vote for Nixon as the least worst candidate. Uh-huh. And then when Nixon was up for re-election, after Watergate, I think
nobody knew about Watergate.
No, but it was after the we didn't know what had happened, but we knew that there'd been a break-in at the Democratic.
You voted for Nixon over McGovern then?
I voted for Nixon over McGovern because I thought McGovern was just too out of the question. I mean, just too
caricature of a liberal.
Yeah, he was detached. I thought he was totally detached from reality. And I didn't like Nixon much after what I'd been hearing, but I figured, well, at least he's a known, the devil you know, I guess, versus the devil you don't know in that case. But no, my politics were, my national politics have always been kind of almost as if the national elections were on another planet. I've been pretty much interested in local elections. And but on the national elections, I never cared too much for the choices. I remember when Harry Truman was running against Tom Dewey, I didn't think too much of the choices, although history has taught me that Truman was probably one of the better presidents of this century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He had a lot of guts, a lot of integrity, and a lot of common sense. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that at the time. But I think I voted for Dewey because it was sort of a time for a change. We had Democrats for so long. I just wanted to see what a Republican would look like in the White House.
Yeah.
But he didn't get in.
In 68, I wonder whether you were attracted to Nixon in a somewhat paradoxical way, as I think some other people were, as the anti-war candidate. I mean, he was talking about his secret plan to end the war.
He was anti-war, and of course he had managed to more or less lay the war on the doorstep of the Democratic Party. When Johnson decided not to run, which was wise, I think, because I think he would have been defeated. Let's see, was it Humphrey was the nominee?
Yeah.
Humphrey was a decent man, and I was kind of torn, really, in that election, because I knew enough by then about the Senate of the United States. I talked to Wayne Morse enough to know quite a bit about the different senators, and I had the feeling that Humphrey was a decent person, but I was a little bit afraid of his tendency to want to give everything away. I mean, he really did want to help people and use the national treasury to do it, and I was a little bit worried about that, and I didn't like Nixon, but I thought Nixon might have a better chance of getting us out of the war. Mm-hmm. But I certainly was not an enthusiastic Nixon supporter. I felt a little bit embarrassed when he appointed me to the federal court because I hadn't really lifted a finger to help him get elected in that election. I had worked for Citizens for Eisenhower in 1952, but that was the last time I'd ever said a kind word about Nixon that I could remember. Mm-hmm. And but when the appointment to the federal court came along, I saw it pretty much as a senatorial matter and regarded the presidency as just incidental to it. The president would have appointed anybody that the Oregon senators agreed on. And
yeah. Yeah.
So I didn't feel terribly beholden to the president, although I was grateful.
Yeah.
But I never was really a strong, it's easy for everybody after Watergate to say I was not a strong Nixon man, but I really wasn't. He didn't know me and I didn't know him. We never spoke, except possibly in 1952 with a shake hands or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know anybody in his staff. I met John Mitchell through Mark Hatfield, as a matter of fact. So I just wasn't a strong supporter, and I really wasn't very much interested in the national presidential elections in those days. I was interested, sort of interested, like interested in who wins the Kentucky Derby, but not. I didn't feel any passion about
it. Well, it sounds like you never really had a candidate that you liked enough.
No, actually, I didn't. I didn't feel much confidence in the nominating party convention, party platform, and nominating process. Mm-hmm. I always thought it was pretty much of a showbiz,
yeah.
And it reached for me the ultimate. I think the bottom was the San Francisco convention in 1964 when the Republicans nominated Goldwater.
Mm-hmm.
I remember afterward. The sick joke, which was so true, that Goldwater, everybody says if you vote for Goldwater, he's going to get us involved in a land war in Asia, and we'll be bombing Hanoi and doing all these things. And I voted for Goldwater, and sure enough, we ended up in a land war in Asia, bombing Hanoi. I didn't vote for Goldwater. That was one where I distinctly, I think my wife and I both agreed we weren't going to vote for either one of these turkeys. We went down and voted for Mark Hatfield.
Actually, the hyperbole applied to Goldwater in 64 was more in the nuclear vein. That's what was being talked about a lot. Maybe it wasn't hyperbole, I don't know. You talked about 64 being a low point. In many people's minds, 68 was a low
yeah.
point too. With
well, that was because you had you had Nixon as the Republican candidate with all of his many of his flaws were beginning to emerge.
Yeah. Well, I was talking more about your bringing up the Republican convention of 64 and the Democratic convention of 68.
Well, that was the low point for the Democrats, but
kids got their heads beat in on the streets.
Yeah, I remember that, and I thought, well, it's their turn. You know, the Democrats have been so damn holier than thou about the 64 campaign of the Republicans. Now I thought, well, they're getting theirs.
Yeah.
But it wasn't any satisfaction. It was a sad spectacle.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
You spoke a minute ago about some of your reservations about Hubert Humphrey in 68 and his willingness perhaps to be a little excessively loose with the federal treasury. While that, in fact, the whole Great Society movement of the Johnson years was amounted to an extraordinary expansion of the role of federal government.
Well, I still think that's the large part of the cause for our present difficulty. That is, Johnson insisted on trying to pay for the Vietnam War with the printing press instead of taxes. And instead of making this country pay its way at the time, they just borrowed the money. What they didn't borrow, they printed. And we had inflation and the tremendous growth of the debt. In the meantime, they were paying for all this Great Society stuff.
Yeah.
And in peacetime, it's inexcusable for a country as rich as ours to go into debt in peacetime the way we were. You know, there's no reason to go into debt in peacetime. This country ought to be able to pay its current bills. And so I was really alarmed about the Great Society and this Johnson's idea that you could have guns and butter both and never have to pay for it. And so that's what I meant. I mean, I saw Hubert Humphrey as a decent guy, but he was a much nicer person, a much more trustworthy person than Johnson. But I thought he was totally infected with the Johnson administration idea that you could have guns and butter, and lots of butter. Buttering everybody. And you know how hard it is now for this administration to try to be parsimonious and kill off things like the Small Business Administration and a lot of these. And I think that's kind of a boondoggle. I mean, there have been a lot more staff salaries in the Small Business Administration than there have been small businesses that have succeeded because of whatever the Small Business Administration has done for them. But anyway, those things were going on while we were trying to fight a war, and I just thought it was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Still do. I mean, I think our current president is out of his mind wanting to have this big defense budget and still not raise taxes. Because the only way you can do it is to borrow more money, and they keep borrowing money, then the interest rates are going to go back up again, and we're going to have more inflation and more high interest, which is bad for Oregon. Especially bad for Oregon, but it's bad for everybody else too. But it's especially bad for Oregon because people stop buying houses when interest rates get too high.
Yeah. Well, the reflection of all this ferment in the 60s in your own family, I take it, was fairly mild in a sense, because your children were still young enough not to be too affected by it. It was not until later.
Well, in the 60s, my oldest, in 1969, my oldest son was 17. And he was the only one that was really much affected by the 60s. Mm-hmm. My two daughters were more affected by the continuing turmoil into the early 70s. They were teenagers. But I think fortunately, all of the four children managed to get through this period without having any unfortunate experiences with drugs or anything. But there was a lot of alienation between their generation and mine. And it was, in a lot of personal ways, it was a very traumatic period for our family, because I was, starting in 1969, I was gone a lot from home. And
yeah.
My wife was alone with three teenagers. Our oldest boy went off to college, but he was so sort of disgusted with the war and the resistance to civil rights and so on, that he kind of felt alienated from the establishment. He didn't really want to go to college. He went a couple of years and then quit. And I don't blame it on the war, but it had an unsettling, I mean, all this turmoil had an unsettling effect on him.
Sure.
And then I had the feeling of being away from the family when they needed me, with my wife alone with three kids, three teenagers at home, and all going through various problems of that time. And I mean, I'd be home occasionally, but I was gone a lot, and when I was home, I was so preoccupied with the work that at the office that I wasn't really much of a parent. So I still feel guilty about that. So those weren't easy times.
No.
And then my son, by my first marriage, who's now 40 years old almost, he is 40, yeah, last month. He went through the Vietnam War and had all kinds of trauma connected with that experience, and isn't over it yet.
He actually fought in the war?
Yeah, he was a parachute medic in the worst of the fighting, and had a lot of really horrifying experiences. You know, he'd drop in, the helicopter would drop him into a battlefield, right, you know, while the battle was still going on or just over, and he'd have these GIs bleeding to death in his arms while he was trying to get tourniquets on them and get them into medevac helicopters and stuff. And he came out of that experience very bitter. And I don't know whether he'll ever really get over it. He's still bitter.
He's
a logger down in Eugene, and he's making a living and has two kids. He's a timber faller, and he's a very competent, strong, physically strong person, but he's has lots of depression and feels unsettled, mm-hmm. insecure, feels cheated, like his youth was taken away, and so on. I mean, the war was just not easy on any of the participants.
And there was the further problem of,
it wasn't a war anybody really approved of.
Yes.
He came home instead of coming like his dad did. I came home from the war in 1946, was a hero. Everybody fell all over themselves being nice to me. When he came home, about half the people treated him as if he was some sort of a pariah.
Right.
And nearly everyone else wanted him to go away, at least not talk about it. They never have been able, that generation never has been able to ventilate their feelings and talk about what the war did to them. That's one reason I'm a little cynical about all these politicians that keep wanting to stir up new adventures overseas.
Yeah.
I just don't think they know what they're talking about.
Another activity in this case, a piece of writing that you did toward the end of that decade, I think, sort of brings together your roles as a public official and a private person, and that's the it's an article you wrote for Northwest Magazine.
Oh, for Jim Magmer, how was that?
For
the Journal.
No, this was Northwest Magazine with the supplement for the Oregonian.
The Oregonian.
Yeah, yeah, and you called it, let's see, keeping the law of the land, yeah. And you dealt with...
Civil disobedience.
Yeah, some of these yeah. larger issues going, being discussed in society at that time, and it came across to me as a piece where you were really dealing with the importance of maintaining balance in all the different impulses that people were feeling at that time, you know, between tearing things down and on the one hand and respecting what existed on the other and what was of lasting importance.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't read that piece. I haven't reread it lately. I don't know whether there's anything in there I would express differently today or not.
Well, it's a fairly, I think, kind of general and almost theoretical piece of writing, which I think does express values that are of you know, long-lasting relevance. Just are making an argument for the fundamental importance of law as the basis for social organization, for one thing, whereas, you know, the whole notion of law was being attacked in mm-hmm. in some sectors at that time. Is in a manner that people pretended was serious, as if we really didn't need any law.
Well, that's still going on in a way. I mean, even at a higher level today in Harvard, at the Harvard Law School, there's a group of young professors who are more or less attacking the radical principles of that is the root principles of Anglo-American law as being irrelevant or being tools of oppression or useful only to those of the property class who wish to exploit the non-property class and so forth. So I suppose a constant tension between the grossly oversimplify it, but the law and order forces on the one side and the anarchists on the other, you know, somewhere in between there, people arrange themselves along the mm-hmm. continuum, but there, in every society, at all times, there's probably a group who thinks that Socrates is corrupting the young, and then there's a group that think that the young are out to dynamite society. Mm-hmm. Civility, the ability of people to live together in large numbers is a fairly fragile thing. And the Japanese have developed a good system in a way, except none of us would probably want to be Japanese in Tokyo right now. But they've lived in a tight little island that's largely overcrowded and have developed an extreme form of courtesy, politeness, and formality to avoid the kinds of stress that would undoubtedly occur if they acted like Americans do, each wanting his own parking place and honking his horn if somebody moves into one ahead of him. So, you know, the Japanese, certain things just simply aren't done, and they found out, I guess, from several centuries of putting up with a very crowded situation that you just have to have a little bit more civil approach to life than you do in the Western frontier, where there's plenty of free land, and if you didn't like the tree that you wanted to build your house next to, you would go find another tree and build uh-huh. your house next to it.